This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
I'm Ying. I'm also a resident here, and seems like today we have a fairly close distance type of group. Redwood City around sort of seems to be the furthest. And I probably have the shortest distance. My bedroom is right below where we sit right now. So, and today I'd like to talk about fear. It strikes me how much in our growing up experience, there's a lot of fear. You know, they say when a new baby comes out, the first feeling that led them to crying is fear. All of a sudden they're in this cold place, as opposed to warm before, without the constant embrace of the mother's body and the sweet nutrition that was constantly available. You know, what is this cold and unfamiliar place? You know, the brain hasn't developed to the extent where we can know what the baby feels like. Memory doesn't work back to then, but one can imagine there's, you know, if we were to put in that kind of situation again, there would be fear, existential fear. I think probably a lot of us can remember the fear that we did feel as children. Maybe some of you can remember being afraid of the dark. I certainly can. How about spiders and the other creepy crawlies? Yeah? Strangers? Of not being liked by your friends? Or being liked and then rejected? Right? The list goes on. Some of those experiences were, you know, intense memories for me. Some of it is hard to explain. What I mentioned of the sort of fear of the unknown of being birthed, my parents tell me of an experience where I was born in a very harsh climate in northeast China. So I was sent to my grandparents down south where it's living is easier for some time, probably a year and a half. So probably between age 1 and 2 and a half, I lived with my grandparents. And then at 2 and a half, they brought me back to the Northeast to live with them. And the grasses have grown so tall that I could not recognize my home. And I burst into tears upon arrival. And, you know, this is what my parents tell me. But when they tell me this, I have this physical feeling of the fear then. And life was difficult in many ways. The actual, subsistence of life then, which luckily changed for the better very soon. But then there's still a lot of internalized fear and anxiety that was a strong part of my growing up experience. To the extent that the internalized fear became a kind of betrayal of my body. And when I was sort of preteen and early teenager, I started to lose control of my body in ways that really scared me. I started to stutter a bit, and I even sometimes could not control my bladder properly. And can you imagine, you know, I was a girl, 11, 12, 13 years old. I was mortified with fear. I had this faint feeling that I was looking at a life of isolation, awkwardness, and sort of this inexpressible difficulty of being alive. But what has saved me was given to me some years earlier. I had experiences in the small pockets of nature around the university campus that I grew up in that affirmed me. In particular, the impermanent beauty of the peach blossoms in the spring affirmed me. The majesty of the sycamore maples, especially when it's backlit by a streetlight. The pure delight of a water droplet that's a perfect sphere on the lotus leaves rolling around. And things like that. It was everywhere. And I felt like it showed me the secret of the universe. Do you guys want to know what the secret of universe is, as experienced by a 5 or 6 year old? Okay. Lift your eyes and look outside for a moment at the leaves. We know that light, if broken down by a prism, is a rainbow. And at times, I felt like I can perceive that rainbow in every facet of everything. And when you look, you know, when we look through our eyes, you know, this is super high fidelity, right? And every pixel is formed of these dazzling facets of infinite richness. And when you look at the leaves, you can also see that it's moving. So you never know where the next moment that cluster of leaves you're looking at would be. So every moment it's perceived anew, like fireworks. So it is a dazzling fireworks that is being constantly perceived by your retina and by your brain, and you experience it each moment anew. And what the second part of that secret, what this feels like, you know, if I were to try to communicate this, I would ask you to sort of concentrate your sensation on the tip of your tongue. Every child has a sweet tooth, right? And the experience of the tip of your tongue with something sweet on it, like honey, candy, the experience of being alive is like that. It's like the little taste buds on the tip of your tongue when it's in touch with honey. And the secret told me that it's always there, whenever I wanted it, in infinite abundance. And that I'm alive so as not to forget that. And of course I do forget that. You know, life continued to be very difficult. And however, it is these small experiences that gave me an inner certainty that allowed me to look at the fears of my life, the challenges, and know that it's all going to be okay. So I would say that is a basis for having no fear. And then what does the actual act of no fear looks like? I'll give you a couple of examples. My mother, who's, you know, this old Chinese woman, 5'1", one time she walked out onto her street to see this big black guy, you know, trying to break into her car. And without thinking about it, she just walked up straight to him and yelled at him. And he quickly ran away. I had a friend named David Kibbe. And he told me this little incident that always impressed me. He and his wife lived in a Berkeley flats in a bungalow. And one sort of, you know, late night, he and his wife woke up to someone, to the noise of someone who had broken into their house. And also without thinking about it, he just jumped up, you know, went into the room where the guy was at, grabbed the guy's wrist, led him through that room, the hallway, the kitchen, the living room, out the front door, and told him to do something better with his life. Done. You know, no fight, no hiding, no strategizing what to do. He did the simplest thing, and he was resolved. A few years after that, David died of lung cancer, and he put up quite a fight with his cancer. Eventually, he lost it, and I think he's remembered by everyone who's met him. So I would say what having no fear looks like is being able to take action without hindrances, acting in the moment. The sutras say, mind is no hindrance. Without hindrances, no fears exist. And at times I feel like I have little glimpses of that. And sometimes it's not even like actual dangerous situations. It's just little moments of discomfort. My dad, in China, you know, there are often panhandlers who come inside restaurants. You know, these are sort of very common restaurants, and, you know, they come around asking for money. And my dad, in his very, you know, occasionally socially awkward but very straightforward way, just asked this young man, you know, he said, "You're able-bodied, why not do something useful?" And he meant it not to feel superior in any way, he actually meant it, you know. And the young man was a little bit shocked, and, you know, I was very young, I felt slightly embarrassed, but I think I can see the wisdom of what he said. Sometimes we all need to be jolted out of the things that we're doing. So when I was in my 20s and 30s, I had a couple of small realizations. One is that if we wait until we're ready to do something, then we're never going to start anything. You know, people sometimes say, feel the fear and do it anyway. And the second realization is that to have an extraordinary life is actually very easy. It's just to be able to do the little things that most people would not do because it's a little too hard, it's a little too cold out there, it's a little too uncertain, it's a little too uncomfortable, it takes a little too long, etc. And these small things is what lives, extraordinary lives, are made of. To give a very sort of trivial example, you know, I needed to change a car battery in my Honda Civic. I go to the auto supply store and buy a battery. I come back to the parking lot. I decide to take a look under the hood, and I look at it, and I decide I could probably do this. So I go back to the supply store and ask for a wrench. And it wasn't super straightforward. It took a long time of fussing around, but eventually I did it, and I go back and return the wrench and the old battery. And they said, they were kind of amazed because they said, "You're the only woman who have ever done this, you know, in decades of this store being open." And I was like, okay, you know, why the heck not? Why would I have someone else do something that I could actually do? You know, I'm involved in the conversation of women in the field of technology, and I must say, and it's not only women, but we all often take our own power away by not doing something that's just slightly challenging or slightly unclear how we can go about doing it. There's power to be taken everywhere in the world. There's plenty of treasure hidden in plain sight if you were just to go grab it. So I would say we're all ordinary people, very ordinary. Every single person in the world is ordinary. But we're ordinary people living extraordinary lives. We're ordinary people doing extraordinary things. Sometimes it's easier to see that in a moment of disaster, right? Like people rise to extraordinary circumstances and do amazing things of courage. But I also know that each person is capable of that. We have basic goodness, and we all have so much courage. Any life takes courage. I was in Nepal a few years ago, and right now I don't know if everyone I've met there is actually alive, if they're okay. we went to this alternative school with about maybe 100 or 200 kids. And the schoolmaster was this pretty amazing man who his upbeatness can almost be grating at times. You know, and he sent out these periodic emails. It's always just overflowing with love and gratitude. And I want to read his recent email, which was the most somber one that he's ever sent. Dear all, namaste. Thank you very much for your soothing messages. Your prayers, thoughts, and love have encouraged us, inspired us, and enabled us to cope with this most heartbreaking situation and greatest difficulty that we have ever felt before. We felt deadliest experience on Saturday when the school building started moving like a swing. At one point, we had lost the hope of life, but with God's grace and your prayers and wishes, we all came out unhurt and safely. Since then, we have been staying outside, sleeping in tent, school van, and bus. We're now cooking our meal and will soon have our lunch and hope that we will then begin to get into the building. We're indeed so nervous. We have not felt any earthquake since last one yesterday night. With warmest regards, Vishnu. He's an ordinary person. But can you imagine being with 100, 200 kids who must be so scared for their lives? What do you do to make sure they're as comfortable as they can to soothe their fears? But if any one of us were there, we would all do the right thing. We would all somehow find the ability to comfort and to be comforted. I want to share one more incident from my own life. It's something I didn't necessarily always feel like it had a big part in my journey or in my psyche, but recently I had, it came back to me as maybe I didn't give it as much significance I actually played. I think part of my healing may have something to do with this. When I was 14, I had this time of carbon monoxide poisoning. In China, we didn't have hot running water. And my father and the apartment my father and I lived in didn't have the hot water heater. So I went to a neighbor's house where I have the key. You know, I have the key to her place to take a shower using, you know, its propane-powered hot water heaters on the wall. And, you know, often mysterious things in our lives happen. We just never know why. The setup was perfectly fine, but for some reason there was carbon monoxide. And I remember feeling in the shower like I was very strangely very tired, and remember telling myself, I better hurry up and get done with the shower. And I lost consciousness. A few hours later, probably my father had the sense that something was not quite right, and he and a couple neighbors found me. And luckily, the warm water kept my body warm, so probably my systems were, you know, functioning longer than it would have otherwise if it was cold. And the neighbor later told me that, you know, my body actually released its bowel, so it was pretty serious. I think in one way, this experience made me feel like death is not much to be scared of. It's kind of like going into this very dense sleep. And in some ways even had a sort of sweetness to it. But only when I was an adult was I able to connect maybe with my father's experience, what it might have been like for him. You know, what it must have been like for him to see his only child unconscious in a tub, you know, who had soiled herself and who may be dying. My father never said anything about this to me, and I have gratitude for for him, for not saying anything and for saving my life. Last week, Mike talked about love here at the talk. And indeed, I see love and fear as being very related, you know. It's impossible to love without experiencing fear. Have you all read Khalil Gibran's The Prophet? No? I highly recommend it to anyone. He spent a lifetime writing this very small book. And for me, it was the beginning of my journey. As soon as I started reading it, I had a sense of recognition and returning to what I had experienced at around 5 or 6 years old. And the very first thing he talked about was love. So the very first spiritual literature that I heard was this, and I'll say a couple paragraphs of it. When love beckons to you, follow him, though his ways are hard and steep. When his wings enfold you, yield to him, though the sword hidden among his pinions may wound you. Pinions are like the wing feathers. And when he speaks to you, believe in him, though his words may shatter your dreams as the north wind lays waste the garden. For even as love crowns you, so shall he crucify you. Right? In no uncertain terms, he was talking about this is hard. And then Khalil Gibran uses a lot of very devotional and even sexualized imagery to talk about how you would essentially be kneaded as bread and baked so that you become a part of God's sacred feast. And this is done to you so that you may know your own heart, and in that process become a fragment of life's heart. And then he talks about fear a little bit. He said, if in your fear you would seek only love's peace and love's pleasure, then it is better that you cover your nakedness and pass out of love's threshing floor into the seasonless world where you shall laugh, but not all of your laughter, and weep, but not all of your tears. I think we all get to know some of this in our experience of living, right? You know, Jung also said that life is brutal and cruel, but at the same time, it is one of divine beauty. The meaning and the meaninglessness exist at the same time. Fear is important for our survival and for our ability to thrive. I sometimes like to make up words that I feel like should exist, so I will say for our survival and for our thrival. But I then look on the internet, and actually multiple people have tried to invent this word before. It's actually in the Urban Dictionary. And the definition, according to the Urban Dictionary, is adjective. For looking beyond your soul into the deepness of society's problems, sacrificing yourself and going beyond one's comfort zone to help the people around you. Not a bad definition. So then the practice of surpassing, going beyond our fear, is then being with experience as it is. Mike talked about love being one, you know, the practice of love, being trying to be straightforward, with a sense of vitality. So then the practice of not having fear and the practice of love are one and the same. And so is the same with everything. a straightforwardness along with a vitality. For me personally, it is to not forget, to recognize and to return to the dazzle and the sweetness of life at each moment. The moments when I realize that are the moments when I'm awake. And in reality, we're always awake. Just sometimes we don't realize it. Your wakefulness is always there for you. I heard another really good quote yesterday. Life isn't here to make you happy, it is here to awaken you. In those moments where you can feel your body, your breathing, what's around you, each other, there may be fear as part of the experience, but like any other experience, it has a reason to be there. It's good for your survival and your thrival. And it is here to awaken you. Last week, Mike also did a little bit of a metta meditation, loving kindness meditation. So maybe we could do a little bit of that as well. So go ahead and feel your body. Maybe close your eyes. It doesn't matter if you're familiar with the typical metta meditation or not. This is a little bit with a spin on my part. Rest your awareness gently on the out-breath. If your back hurts a little bit, if you feel tension in your shoulder, imagine that maybe you're standing chest deep in the ocean, and the gentle wave comes and rolls your shoulders back a little bit. And bring to mind someone who's close to you, someone who brings you warmth and comfort. Wish this person to be happy, to be at peace, to be relaxed, to be well. I'm going to use the word I in the next sentence, but this is not I as in Ying speaking, nor is it you who's repeating these words in your mind. This is the I that your finger cannot point to. So in your mind, say this person's name. And say to them in your mind, you're so brave and beautiful, and I am so proud of you. And now bring to mind someone who is challenging, who you're not sure how to interact with, how to resolve some kind of a tension between you. And say their name in your mind. And say to them, you're so brave and beautiful, and I am so proud of you. And then come back to yourself. Because in the Western world, it is harder for us to be kind and loving to ourselves. And for this part, maybe you want to put your palms on your hara, just below your navel. Or whatever feels comfortable for you, but some kind of a contact. Maybe it is with your cheek. And say your own name and say, you're so brave and beautiful. And I am so proud of you. And relax your hands. Open your eyes. So that's what I wanted to share. I would love to hear some questions, thoughts, and comments. Camille.
Thank you for your talking. It's very moved.
Thank you.
I have no idea what I'm going to say, but if I wait in that space, then I just allow fear to come up. So I just figured I would.
Thank you. Something. Right, right.
Yeah. I really like the connection between fear and love. And the word courage coming from a root of heart. Mm. I think love, you know, when you fully love, I've had that experience of it bringing up the fear. I've also had the experience of, I think Mike used the word last week of wholeheartedness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the sense of how, like you're saying, you can, the fear is there. If you have fear, you know, can you open to that?
Yeah.
And hold it in your heart, and at the same time, you know, listen to your heart and be,
yeah,
just trust in that.
Yeah.
I found very helpful.
Yes, yes, thank you. Yeah, it brings, you know, everything that we feel is useful information for us. You know, whether negative or positive, it doesn't really matter. But what you said bring to mind, you know, in many spiritual traditions in the world, they talk about the sense of being a warrior, right? You know, the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna is the greatest warrior, yet he was paralyzed with fear. You know, he collapsed. He could not take the next action. So the thing isn't try to like puff yourself up and say, I am such a great warrior, but it is to take in that fear, to know that fear comes from love, the love of his brethren, right? The love of not wanting to inflict violence and accepting all that and then going and doing what needs to be done. And that is then not personal. It is what life wants us to do. Some of it may be very difficult. Some of it involve pain to us and to others. But if it comes from love, then we can have that warriorship. And we are all that. We're all warriors, you know. Tibetan Buddhism talks a lot about this as well, you know. The warrior facing the eastern sun. You know, it comes from the same source. And trusting your basic goodness. That's a basis. That's a basis for having no fear. Yeah. Other comments or I guess maybe, yes, Saiko.
Thank you so much for sharing the deepest part of you, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Hi.
I really appreciate it. You brought into light most the fascination with the leaves blowing in the wind.
Yeah.
And like I've always been like interested in just like seeing it, but I never knew why. And
then, yeah.
Like, it's, every moment is something new. But,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, it always used to amaze me why people don't notice things like this, honestly. Because to me, like, there's nothing more beautiful than a tree that's backlit with, you know, in a gentle breeze, and there's always movement. And I remember the feeling like, this is a church, you know? And this is when I was really young. But I had that feeling like, yes, I understand. I understand why people go to church. They go to church to be lifted, but I feel lifted looking at this tree. So, thank you.
Thank you. describing birth and the first moment out. It's also our first breath, and we haven't had a chance to use it until then. So maybe there's some awe there as well in that first experience.
Absolutely. Yeah. 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 I wish I knew that when I was much younger. I think I, as a child, my experience was like very much dominated by some of the negative feelings. But yeah, I can see that must have been there. I do have a feeling that often I feel the sweetness of breathing, you know? That there's a very subtle deliciousness to it. And in meditation, I learned to appreciate that more. So indeed, every breath is like, you know, drinking from the most delicious fountain of water of life.
Yes. Wonderful talking.
Thank you.
It's interesting because at some point when I was sitting among all the other random thoughts that popped into my head, I thought that we're all born blind. The eyes open or a few days, and then it seems like we have to spend lots of time groping through, finding our way in the world. And, this came up years and years ago. I was on a long trip with this friend of mine. And he was kind of a new ager and read literature that I didn't read. But he told me about this book, Your Ranch, I think it's called. Supposedly it was like a revelatory, angels handed things down. And he said, but the angels, the one thing they were puzzled by, they didn't understand about human beings, was why do we put this one emotion, fear, above everything else? And that, you know, just trumps. And I thought that was a striking way to put it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, I guess it's because our survival.
Yeah.
You said about fear of the dark.
Yeah.
It's ancient.
Yeah, yeah.
You hear a noise, it could be a leopard.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you have to just immediately run up the tree, you know, there's no...
Yeah.
But then we can be quiet when you're in the tree. And
yeah.
Bring your stability back.
Yeah.
Or see the leaves, like you.
Yeah, indeed, I understand the evolutionary need for fear, because like, clearly if you don't feel joy, your body's going to be fine. But if you don't feel fear, you know, and also, you know, for most of human evolution, the survival rate of babies is very, very low, of children, you know, even up until 50, 40 years ago. And this is only a recent thing that most babies survive. So yes, indeed, they need to make a fuss whenever they don't feel right. Yeah, and I also have the experience for me that sometimes, you know, this eye changes, but then the body changes a little slower. It needs to catch up. So certainly, you know, if you asked me 10 years ago, speaking in front of a group of people, I'd be like, no way, right? So probably sometime after this talk, and I have experiences, you know, still of this, like my body would shake. So I have this delayed reaction of the fear. Yet the body has a lot of intelligence. It won't shake to the degree that it stops me from functioning, yet it's clearly there. So my body is still adapting to this new self or this constantly changing self that I can speak from the heart, you know, without planning everything out, but then, you know, it's catching up. But now I experience fear more like a attentive wakefulness, like a heightened awareness, rather than debilitating, depressing, grave, like, you know, that makes me not want to move, that kind of fear. So fear has a huge role in my life. It forces me to focus, right, a lot. I ride a motorcycle, and fear is very useful there too. But I don't experience it the same way I used to many years ago.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.